Thanks, Daniel. So I guess I will give you some report of what, in my mind, what I know about progress in silicon. I'm sure I have skipped some things there in the talk, but I tried to be as thorough as I could. So what I'm going to do first is to just give you some background to what really we mean by silicon quantum computing, what kind of proposals are there, and what kind of experimental progress that have been made during the past few years. And then I will kind of pick on three relatively recent works we have done on silicon in three different directions. Wherever I get to in an hour, I'll stop there. Okay. So let me first acknowledge my collaborators. These silicon works I have been working on, I guess, since 2001. I have mostly been in collaboration with Velita Koiler and Shankar Dasharma. For the silicon hyperfine calculation we did, we were in collaboration with Lucy Asali, Helena Petrilli, and Rodrigo Capas from Brazil. And on the Silicon Valley calculations, oops, I should have put in another name of a student of Velita's. And then on the Silicon Valley implication, it was in collaboration with Dimi Kotzer, Chiu-Tzu Lee, and Luke Swinsky. All of them are in Shankar's group. And on the some silicon phosphorus coherence calculation, it was in collaboration with Wayne Witzel, who is now in Sandia National Lab. I also got some experimental slides. They come from Andrea Morello from University of New South Wales in Australia, Mark Erickson from University of Wisconsin, and Hong Wu Liu, who is now in Sendai, but his experiments were done back in NTT when he was, I think, a postdoc in NTT. And these works were supported by LPS, NSA, for the past 10 years. And this year I was visiting JQI, and some of the silicon work was really kind of grew out of that. So let me start out with a very basic introduction about silicon quantum computing. I would say that all these different works on silicon quantum computing grew out of the original Lars Stevens-Senso proposal of using quantum dots. And using, more particularly, using electron spins trapped in quantum dots as qubits. And one of the key idea in that proposal was that, well, when you do that, and when you introduce tunneling between neighboring dots, you get exchange coupling between the electrons. And that, because it's a Coulomb interaction, it's actually a strong interaction, allows you to have very strong interactions and fast two-qubit gates. Okay, so the basic idea there is that you use the electron spin, you know, spin up, down in the field as your qubit, and you can do one qubit control using a ESR type, you know, put a magnetic field, and then split the spin up and down level, and then put in a transverse field to rotate the spin. You can do it, you know, not only through a magnetic field, but also through electrical field, if you have spin-orbit interaction, for example, or in homogeneous magnetic environment. And for two-qubit coupling, it's through exchange. The readout, you know, spin is a very small magnetic object, right? It's one Bohr magneton, so it's very hard to read out. And as was discussed yesterday, you know, one reason the squid is easier to read out is because it's, you know, it's thousands of Bohr magneton when a single spin is actually just one. So it's a much harder object to read out. So the idea mostly in the field these days, people are using to convert the spin information into charge. Okay, so connect the spin up and down information into a charge here and there information. And the charge detection is something that people are, at least back in the 90s, already knew very well. You know, you can use a single electron transistor or quantum point contact to easily distinguish whether a charge is close by or a bit further away. Okay. So the advantage of this proposal, other than what I mentioned before, the very fast two-qubit gates, is that, you know, spins in semiconductors, at least in the materials that we know of, we want to use gallium arsenide or silicon, these are materials where spin has very long coherence time, lifetime and coherence time. So, for example, right now in gallium arsenide, you know, the experimental progress are, I would say, further along compared to silicon. People already measured, for example, a T1, which is spin flip time for electron is in the order of second. Well, that really depends on the field, but I'm just throwing a number there. And the T2 time, which, you know, 100 microsecond is really after you do CPMG pulses. Okay, that's what I suppose Amir Jacoby will talk about within a few weeks. And they get a pure hard echo times, just, you know, really simple spin echo time, I think 30 microseconds or something, pretty long compared to, you know, charge coherence time and things like that. Okay. And, you know, solid state, we always think that solid state probably is a bit more scalable compared to atomic systems. You know, that I'm not as convicted, just because, you know, we have classical scalable technology in our computers. Doesn't mean that we would have scalable technology in solid state for quantum technology. But that's something that we have to study, we have to explore. Okay, so this proposal came out in 97, actually, posted on in 97, I'm pretty sure, because I started working in this field back in 98, and that was one of the first papers I read. Okay, so in this proposal, I don't remember at least whether Daniel and David really mentioned that, well, we want to use gallium arsenide or we want to use silicon. They want to use semiconductors. Okay, and it turned out at that time, gallium arsenide technology is much more progressed, so many experimentalists start working on that in gallium arsenide. But there is also a question, well, can you do it in that other different material system? And one of the first material you can think of is silicon. Right? Silicon is behind all our current generation computers, and it is actually known that silicon has very good spin coherence properties, but that I will discuss next. And one thing, you know, when you talk about these gated quantum dots, where you really first produce a 2D electron gas at one of the interfaces there, and then you grow metallic gates on top, and that will deplete the electron under it and produce, you know, kind of puddles of electrons here and there. Those are technologies where you have very good control of the electron states. On the other hand, you also don't have very good, you don't have very uniform size and energies and things like that. Okay, there are certain degree of uncontrollable, you know, differences between different dots. Okay, so there is also a question about that. You know, you want your qubits to be as close as it possible to each other. Okay, so one of the things that, you know, really kind of give you some idea is that, well, you not only can have these gated quantum dots in semiconductors, you actually have some natural quantum dots in there as well. Okay, so I'm just bringing this very simple slide up here. Think about silicon, you know, this talk is about silicon. Think about silicon, it has 14 protons and 14 electrons to it, right? And let's say we put a phosphorus atom into silicon. Okay, phosphorus has one more electron, one more proton. So next to it on the periodic table. So what you do here is you put the phosphorus here, and what you now have, you know, 14 of those electrons would be used to satisfy all the covalent bonds to its neighbors, and then you have one extra electron. Well, that presumably should move around in the silicon, but because you also have an extra proton here, you effectively have a kind of a hydrogen atom there. Okay, now for this hydrogen atom, you know, in the simplest picture, you would think of silicon as kind of a gallium background, a continuum background, but it does produce a different mass for the electron to move in silicon. And also there is screening, there is a dielectric screening for the electron interaction. So the Coulomb interaction will be different. It would have a dielectric constant of 13. 12, I think, for silicon. And then there's the effective mass. Okay. So you can think of a phosphorus donor like that, where the donor electron, if it is not ionized, it will be confined to this proton and move around there. So then you would have a quantized orbital state, you know, a quantized orbital motion, and then you can think about using the spin of that electron as your qubit, right? So instead of, you know, using a surface gate, now you just use that proton as the source to provide you the confinement. Okay? So you can estimate some of these numbers. You'll find that the Bohr radius is about 30 angstrom, and in fact the ionization energy is about 45 millielectron volt. Think about room temperature is 30 millielectron volt. So it's a pretty large confinement energy. And you know, presumably if you go to lower temperature, then you would reliably have one electron on each of these donors, and you can think about, really think about using them as your qubit, okay, spin, electron spin qubit. And you can also calculate the exchange if you have two of these donors next to each other. Okay, and in fact that was calculated back in the 60s for hydrogen, two hydrogen atoms, and you have a pretty nice a smooth varying exchange coupling there. Okay, so one advantage of using such a system as a qubit is that you actually have identical qubits, right? So that, I think, is one of the reasons that motivated Bruce Kane to actually think about using, proposing to use silicon as the host material for a spin qubit. Okay, now he thought about using the nuclear spin of that phosphorus. You know, the phosphorus, natural phosphorus is 100% phosphorus 31, which has a spin half for the nuclear spin. Okay, so you can use that nuclear spin for sure. And I think, you know, through discussions with him and, you know, reading his paper, I guess his two main motivations were that you have these very highly coherent donor states, donor electron and nuclear spin states. Okay. In fact, George Fier, who invented these electron nuclear double resonance experiments, did a lot of measurement on silicon phosphorus system back in late 50s and early 60s, back in the 20th century, last century. And they found that for the electron, the relaxation time is in the order of thousands of seconds. And the nuclear spin relaxation time was like tens of hours. I don't think they did T2 measurement, but the latest T2 measurement in a isotopically purified silicon for electron trapped around donors is about a second. Okay, 0.3 second. Was done in Steve Lyon's group in Princeton. I think they're trying to get to a second, but they haven't been successful with that. Okay. And so, you know, you see that these are quite long coherence times, if you think about this, you know, compared to yesterday when Jake was mentioning in a ion Wigner crystal, which has the longest electron spin T2 time, that's like 1,000 seconds, right? So this is quite long, you know. Generally in solid state, you have much shorter T2 time compared to that. Okay. So that was the main motivation. Certainly, there's also the question of, you know, silicon supposedly is the dominant technology these days. So if you're in a fight, in Bruce's word, you want to be on the same side of it with this 800-pound gorilla. But I guess, you know, that's just metaphors, not real there. Okay. And so, you know, it sounds like a very attractive proposal, and that really kind of get some people working on this, and in particular the Australian government and many groups got together and they put in a huge effort starting from about that time, you know, late 1990s, all the way to now. I don't know what is the future, but they have been very well funded to study how to use these donors for the quantum computing purpose. Now it turns out it's very hard, you know, to control a single atom in a solid and to put them where they should be. All these are very hard technical questions that I would say they are making progress to address, but they are still not there yet. Okay. So now, basic idea in Bruce Kane's proposal is that you use the nuclear spin, right? And then you put gates, you try to grow gates atop the phosphorus atom. And then you use gates to move the electron off and on to the nuclear spin. And because of the hyperfine interaction, now you have this A that can be controlled so that you can control the interaction between the electron and nuclear spin. And that will allow you to rotate the nuclear spin selectively. Basically, the electron provide a different night shift to selected nuclear spin, and then you can do put in RF field to rotate the spin. And for two spin interaction there, for two qubit operation, what you do is to use exchange interaction between the two electrons. Okay, so you have two phosphors with two electrons there. The nuclear spin interaction is mediated by these two electrons that can overlap and then create an exchange splitting between the two electrons. Okay, so you can see that the idea here for this silicon-based scheme, even though it uses nuclear spin as qubit, it still uses electron exchange. Okay, so the control of that exchange would be a pretty important factor in this proposal. Okay, now you can use that Heron-Flicker formula to calculate that exchange, but it turns out that, well, silicon is not as simple as a real continuum gallium model. It's a crystalline material, right? So what it has, the underlying structure of silicon is a diamond lattice, where silicon go into a two FCC lattices shifted by a quarter lattice constant. Okay, and what it does is it produces a band structure for the electrons to fill in. So the energy spectrum forms bands of available states. So compare that to gallium arsenide. Gallium arsenide, the lowest unoccupied band has its minimum at the center of the Brillouin zone. Okay, so that's the kind of the zone of the reciprocal lattice where, you know, the electron wave factor can occupy. Okay, so that there, if you put an electron into gallium arsenide, its behavior really looked like when the electron is outside in the vacuum, just with a different effective mass, with different dielectric constants. Okay, but for silicon, it turned out the conduction band minimum are not at the center of the Brillouin zone. Instead, it's actually far away towards the X points. Basically, let me see. I think I have a slide here. So they are actually far away towards the Brillouin zone boundary, actually 85% out to the boundary, and along the X, Y, and Z directions. Okay, so there are actually six degenerate conduction band minima. So you say, well, what does that to do with me when I only care about the spin and the nuclear spin? This is the electronic orbital states, right? Presumably, I separate the spin state and the orbital state. But as we know now, the exchange interaction that we use to control the two-spin interaction, that actually has Coulomb nature to it, right? It's, in essence, a Coulomb interaction. So, you know, if your orbital state has complexities, and that could have implications to your spin interaction. And it turned out that is actually the case. Okay, so you know, in the silicon, if you put a phosphorus in there, when you write down the single electron wave function, turn out the ground orbital wave function would be an equal superposition of all these six valleys. Okay, and you know, each of the block function has a you know, a K mu, for example, that K, which is 85% of 2π/8, and then, you know, the periodic part of the block function can be expanded on the reciprocal vectors. Okay, but it has a very fast oscillating feature to it. And when you actually calculate the exchange between two such donor states, what you see is that the exchange actually depends quite sensitively on the relative position of the two donors. Okay, so imagine if you have, let's say, in a big lattice, you have two phosphors sitting at two identical lattice positions. Okay, let's say both are sitting here at that position of the lattice. Okay, so this one sits here, the other one sits somewhere, let's say moved by 100 lattice constant. If you move that position just to its nearest neighbor, okay, and then your interaction goes down, I think nearest neighbor is the right one, goes down from something like a fraction of MeV down to a much smaller value, much closer to a zero value, you know, smaller than at least by at least one order of magnitude. And if you move on to the next nearest neighbor, second nearest neighbor, again, you could actually get the same exchange, but you could also get some very suppressed exchange. Okay, so basically it's just an interference effect between the different valleys, and when you have two centers, then this interference comes into play to affect your exchange coupling. Okay, so that becomes it's a theoretical calculation that we did back in 2002. That did draw some attention from the experimentalists, but they kind of feel that, well, you know, maybe by having strains and other things in my system, we could overcome this very strong interference. After all, this is a simple effective mass calculation that may or may not come out true when you have a realistic kind of dirty system, right? Although I would say that later on, I think in 2005 or 2006, some theorists in Australia also calculated with much more sophisticated description of the electron wave function, and they come out with results very similar to ours. The suppression is maybe not as bad, but it's still pretty prominent there. Okay. Definitely, that's a very good question. So these are calculations done in the bulk where you have 06 values involved. When you're close to a surface, generally you will have strain or you have confinement along the surface that will lift the valley degeneracies, so that generally only two valleys would be involved. Okay. So there, this kind of changes would be less dramatic, but in certain directions you will still have that. Okay, the interference effect will still be there because you still have two valleys involved in your calculation or in your electronic states. Okay, you cannot really completely fully lift all these degeneracies just by, you know, moving it close to an interface. But I will talk about the valley splittings a bit later. Okay. So that is a question, and that actually get a lot of people also think, well, why are we trapped by donors? Okay, it's an identical qubit, it's its advantage, but maybe the strong Coulomb interaction that actually breaks all this translational symmetry and gave me this valley interference effect can be overcome if I move back to quantum dots, right? So that pushed people to actually think about using silicon quantum dot in either silicon germanium or silicon dioxide type of material. So let me just kind of comment on a few recent experimental studies of these silicon systems. This first slide is still on donors. Okay, this is provided by Andrea Morello. So the system they have is they actually grow a system on, this is a silicon dioxide type of material, but they actually implanted three donors. Well, they implanted a few, but they know three of them are close to the quantum dot over there. So essentially this is a source drain quantum dot system, so a single electron transistor, and they implanted a few donors nearby to the island. Okay. And so this is kind of the energy diagram they have. You will have a donor close to the quantum dot, and if you adjust the Fermi surface of the quantum dot close to the donor energy levels, then there potentially would be dynamics between the donors and the quantum dot. Okay. So they have done that. They have actually identified through Coulomb blockade experiments, identified that they do actually have three over there, because you know the donor right next to the island, they are very close to the island. So whether they are charged or discharged will have a very strong effect on the Coulomb blockade of the single electron transistor. Okay, it's like a fraction of E on the effect on the on the ICT. So they can see it very clearly. Okay. So now, if you apply a magnetic field and split that spin state, it is possible actually to distinguish the spin up and down state for the donor. Okay, so you know a donor is nearby that can tunnel couple to the single electron transistor, and if you now apply a B field, then spin up and down will have a pretty large energy difference. The G factor for electron in silicon is 2, so it's much bigger than gallium arsenide. So you know, if you apply, let's say, a 1 Tesla field, already the splitting is in the same order as like a 5 Tesla field in gallium arsenide, right? So you can split these spin states pretty easily. And now if you can think of putting the Fermi level in between, for example, the spin up and down states, then you can actually, by looking at the transport signal in the SET, you can tell whether you have originally a spin up or down states. Okay, so what they did was this. They first raised the Fermi level up here above both of those states, make sure the donor is charged. Then they lower the Fermi level down to between these two levels. Okay, so now if a spin was there in the spin up state, it will hop out onto the SET. Right? It has higher energy, so it will hop out. Okay, and that make the donor discharge, the SET Coulomb blockade will move. If the spin was originally down, then you know, Fermi level is still above its level, so the spin cannot come out, the electron cannot come out, and the current through the SET will be unchanged compared to before. Okay, so that's basically what they were observing. You know, if the spin was down, then you look at the current of ICT, this is what you get. If actually it was up, it was in the higher energy state, then as soon as you move your Fermi level down there, it will hop, the electron will hop out into the ICT island, and that gives you a peak in the current. Okay, it will not stay up there because after it hop out, it becomes empty, then another electron from the island will come in to the ground state, right? So it will put the donor back to a charged state. Okay, so the current will come back down here. So then depending on whether you have a peak or not, you know originally whether you had an electron up or down. Okay, it's a very similar experiment to the Yaron Elzerman's experiment back in 2004, and then in Delft, in Krugerhoven's group. There, they did experiments in the gallium arsenide quantum dot. Here, it's, you know, it's phosphorus, but it's really very, very similar. Okay. And I think in that experiment, they used charge sensing, basically putting a charge detector next to the quantum dot. Well, here, you know, if you think of that as a quantum dot, then this is your charge sensing, right? The ICT is your charge sensing that detects whether the donor is charged or not charged. Okay, so this was a pretty new experiment, and I can tell they were pretty excited that they actually got these things.
Is this the signal from one single electron? Because you say you have three donors there.
Yeah, so what they could do is they could go around in the Coulomb diagram and identify, you know, where one of the donor will have the strongest effect, and then they park their system there. So it is actually a single donor event. Okay, and so these are actually single spin events, very similar to the Elzerman experiment.
I realize this is not your term.
No.
So we don't ask you back for the details about it. But I'm curious whether they're able to constrain this to be the phosphorus donor related electron spin, or if that's not the question.
Good question. I think they were able to be relatively sure. I have his talk where he, so this was the Coulomb diagram that they have, and they were looking at different charge transfer events between the donors and the...
No, I'm trying to understand that. Is there any way they can tell whether this is a phosphorus impurity?
Or some other impurity? Ah, okay. For that, I don't think they are 100% sure. They could go measure, I think... for sure, yes.
Electron popping on and off is not, you know,
not definitely. Yes, yes. No, I think that's something that they're not 100% sure. I think they are reasonably sure because, you know, if you have a charge trap, presumably when you do the Coulomb experiments, you would know that, you know, do the Coulomb blockade, you would know that, well, you have a trap here and there, right?
There's only one experiment they can do to prove it, which is to do ESR dependent
mark. Sure.
Show that it kills.
Right, no, I don't think they are.
Watch this space. It hasn't been done yet, but it will be very shortly.
Excellent. Now, can you measure this anymore? Free spins.
If you can measure the single electron spin, which is what they're saying they're doing,
and
all you have to do is drive the spin on the phosphorus, which is stressed. It has a different resonance frequency than bare spin. And it has a known frequency, well described.
Yeah.
Only a theorist would say all you have to do. I think they've now got it to work with a single phosphorus.
But they can even measure the Zeeman splitting using this technique.
They did.
The Zeeman response depends upon whether this phosphorus bound or not.
But their accuracy for the
I actually don't know whether I can find that. I remember he mentioned about measuring the. They actually did, you know, much more characterization of these charging and discharging regimes, but I just tried to look for. Oh, I couldn't find it. Forget about it.
I think the straight answer to your question is that they don't yet have the
answer. Yeah, they don't know for sure. Right.
But I think they.
But it's.
Yeah, so this is an experiment, I would say this is like one of the more advanced experiments on phosphorus donors. You know, for many years they were struggling with just trying to place the donors in the proper place with selectivity, and afterwards you know where they are and all these things, or just grow them. You know, they took actually two different approaches to put phosphorus into silicon. So, you know, there are a lot of technological difficulties they have to overcome. And this type of physical characterization type of experiments were relatively new. I think only available the past couple of years. Okay, so this was on the donors, and here is a slide from Mark Erickson. These are experiments done in quantum dots in the silicon germanium system. Basically, they grow multiple layers of silicon germanium, produce the right strain, and then grow a layer of, well, produce the relaxed silicon germanium, and then grow a layer of silicon in there. Well, not one layer, but like 10 nanometer or so. So that gives you a strained silicon, and in that way you get a proper band alignment so that you can trap electron in the silicon. Otherwise it would have been the other way around. The electron would tend to stay in silicon germanium. Okay. So they were able to produce these quantum dots and then put, you know, charge sensors, quantum point contacts next to the quantum dot so that they can detect whether the dot is occupied or not. And so using this, they were able to get to the one electron limit, so one electron per dot limit, and one electron or two electron in the double dot type of limit. Okay. And they also were able to observe things like spin blockade, which can be used to measure spins. Okay, so depending on whether the two electron states is a singlet or triplet, you would have a larger or smaller tunneling current through the double dot. That's the basic idea of a spin blockade. And they were able to see it in a silicon germanium double dot. Okay. These are experiments done in the silicon MOSFET type of structure. So it's ID silicon-silicon oxide interface. I think this again is an experiment done in the New South Wales group. So you can see it's very similar to what I showed before from Andreas' slide, but there they didn't implant the phosphors, they just have a quantum dot, a single electron transistor type of configuration. So there, they were able to observe plume blockade and everything, and they claim that they have gone to the zero electron, one electron limit. But this experiment were done in a tunneling type of experiment, and you know, experimentalists know that in this type of experiment, even when your current is zero, it doesn't actually necessarily mean you have no electron anymore. Okay. This, well, you would have to look at there. It's supposedly a gate-defined dot, I think, if I remember correctly. But yeah. It's
there's a lot of messy stuff there, right?
No, but I mean, yeah. All these SRSO2 dots are not depletion.
Yeah. Yeah, they have this, you can see there's these top gates that actually draw the electron from the source and drain towards this region. Now, I think his question is whether those signals were coming from impurities or traps as compared to the quantum dot that they actually want to produce. You know, again, these are just Coulomb blockade experiments, so I would say the likelihood that it is actually the quantum dot is relatively high. But I'm a theorist. I don't know exactly how they did the experiments, right?
I guess they can see the exciting states, right?
I don't think in this paper, in this posting, they actually... Yeah, you can see the exciting states over there. Yeah. You mean going from there?
And that you can estimate the size of
the... Well, they can estimate it. Yeah, they can estimate it, but you know how to correlate these numbers to the actual energy requires more experimental knowledge of, you know, their, let's say, width of their Coulomb peak and those things, right? I cannot do that myself, so I have to go ask them, I guess. Yeah. Okay, but you know, basically, this just shows that there are also some progress in the silicon-silicon oxide type of quantum dots. That at least they were able to produce these, you know, do these transport experiments. I know that, you know, the group in UCLA, Owen Young's group, and also a group in Sandia, they were also trying to do these type of experiments, trying to produce quantum dots in this, you know, FHD type of structure. Okay, so, well, okay, so one other experiment, this was done actually in NTT in Japan. And they have a slightly different structure for their silicon-silicon dioxide type of quantum dot. There, they actually have a buried oxide below the quantum dot as well as above. Okay, so it's kind of sandwiched. You know, you have your quantum dot sandwiched between two layers of oxide. And in fact, they could get a very, very sharp interface there. They reported a 10 MeV value splitting, which is kind of almost two orders of magnitude larger than people ever reported for this type of silicon-silicon dioxide interface. But anyway, you know, whether that is actually true or not, we are not sure, but at least we know that the interface quality actually is very, very good. Okay, and there they were able to do experiments again in terms of, you know, excited state spectroscopy, again looking at the excited states, you know, in the Coulomb blockade regime, and also they were able to produce Coulomb poly blockade, okay, the spin blockade. So I'm using all the time on the experiments. I just want to kind of give you an overall sense. You know, there are, I would say, quite some progress in this field along the line of trying to trap an electron, whether in a donor or in a silicon germanium quantum dot or in a silicon, you know, MOSFET type of structure in a quantum dot. Okay, and there are various degrees of progress for these different quantum dot systems. Probably the silicon germanium dot is right now is really ahead of the other two type of structures, but you never know how those would evolve, those systems will evolve. Okay. So I would say that, you know, for a while, at least personally, I was kind of seeing no progress in silicon at all. So that's a pretty nice change when you actually see that along different directions there are very nice new experiments coming out.
Can you give us the vital statistics, Richard, that T1 and T2?
I will talk about the coherence. I think right now these, I think they and they both are trying to do ESRs. Whether in each case, for donors, we know in the bulk it would be great. The T2, as I mentioned before, already is like a fraction of a second. For quantum dot, I don't think anyone has actually done a measurement for silicon quantum dots. Okay. Now the suspicion is that, when you go to the interface with all the traps and things around the interface, your coherence time would be dramatically shorter. But at least at this stage, I don't know any experiments. Wisconsin group has been able to do single shot measurements. They have done quite a few things. So I imagine this next year, that's what they are trying, probably right now, to do the ESR. Following one of the Gallimard's night schemes, I guess.
The T1 measurement they could do without
this. Sure. I don't know. I don't think they have done T1 measurement. I don't think so. Yeah. Well, now they have.
Surprising. They see the charge going out of the dot and then
like. Yeah. No. T1 measurement. I don't know why they haven't done it, but I imagine with what they have now, they should be able to do it pretty quickly. Okay. They started out really quite behind, right? They start out basically with nothing, and now I think they are probably less than 10 years behind the Gallimard's night dot characterizations. So hopefully they can, if not catch up, at least follow the same lines and try to get more results.
Mm-hmm. That phosphorus in silicon has one of the best T2 times of any condensed matter system for electron spin.
Mm-hmm.
What makes you think that the other two will be as good as that?
No, I don't think they are as good as that.
So why bother?
There are the complexities of how you place the donors, how you couple them, all those things. I think the rationale of pursuing the quantum dots, especially, truth is I don't know. I was making the same question. Well, people are already producing good silicon germanium dots. Why bother even with the silicon dioxide dot, which is known to have a lot of surface traps and everything, a lot of dirt on the surface. But I guess experimentalists want to try, right? And maybe they can get something out of it, learn something about interface, learn something about how the spins lose their coherence, and see, because eventually, if you want to control the phosphorus, you also have to place them in near the interface. Kane's proposal has the phosphorus like 10 nanometer, 20 nanometer away from the interface. It's pretty close to the oxide. Okay, so, if they're really in the bulk, you can only do large-scale ensemble NMR measurement or ESR measurement. You can't really have individual qubit access, right? So I would say, even if this quantum dot eventually turn out to go nowhere and the phosphorus will still turn out to be the best system, this works would still help you to understand, when you are close to interfaces. I think everyone is entitled to their own opinion.
I mean, the speed of compatible quarks over the lifetime of
Okay.
There's more technology for phosphorus spinners in silicon than there is for quarks.
Okay, so, well, I... I'm sure there are, you know, you can think of, these are the fields I would say that are still pretty wide open, where there are different technologies out there, and I don't think people have now settled on a particular technology, whether it's silicon, whether it's solid state, right? So, you know, maybe we move on to the Wigner crystal eventually. Okay, so with the remaining little time I have, I'm going to talk a little bit about the theoretical work we have done. So our works mostly have been concentrated on, you know, on coherence and on valleys. Okay, so let me start out with a single spin coherence discussion. I probably won't have time to talk about valleys, so let me just talk about the coherence here. So in silicon, so this is, you know, in let's say in silicon phosphorus, or actually in silicon quantum dot anyway, if you think about the electron spins, what do who do they interact with? Okay, let's say you have a good quantum dot, you don't have impurities. So then the electron can have spin orbit interaction, has, you know, when you apply field, you have Zeeman splitting, interact with its nuclear spin. If it is phosphorus, it will interact with the phosphorus nuclear spin and whatever other nuclear spin in the environment. If you do have them, the silicon 29. And the nuclear spins could interact with each other through dipolar interaction, or can interact with each other mediated by the electron if they are actually interact with the same electrons. Now, in silicon, you don't actually have nuclear quadrupole interaction because, you know, the only silicon nuclear spins have just been half. Okay, no bigger than half, so no quadrupole interaction there. And the hyperfine interaction, if you think about it, between the electron and nuclear spin is really, at the bottom is a magnetic dipole coupling between the electron and nuclear spin. Okay. So you can write it as a really in a tensor form where you have generally a so-called contact part and also some anisotropic part because, you know, dipolar interaction is anisotropic. Okay. And then you have the dipole-dipole coupling between the nuclear spins. So if you have a, let's say we focus on just a phosphorus system. Okay, so you have a phosphorus atom there, you have a donor electron confined to it. In the environment, you might still have some silicon 29 nuclei around. You know, in silicon, a natural silicon has 95% silicon 28 and 30, and then about 5% silicon 29, which has a spin half. So those nuclear spins could have dynamics that can influence back the phosphorus donor electron spin. Okay, so the understanding of this donor electron decoherence is something that we have been trying to do. So in this particular piece of work that was actually done by Whistle and Dasharma before, they were focused on just the how the nuclear spin, silicon 29 nuclear spin dipole coupling, how that affects the donor electron spin. Okay. And so what they kept from that large electron nuclear spin coupling Hamiltonian is just these two terms. One is the Oberhauser shift, the, you know, the ZZ term between the electron and nuclear spin for the hyperfine interaction. The rationale there is that the flip-flopped part of that hyperfine interaction, you know, shouldn't have a large effect because in a finite field, the electron and the nuclear spin have very different magnetic moments, so they have very different Zeeman splitting, very different energy. And so they cannot flip-flop with each other, so you just keep the Oberhauser term. Now, it turns out the higher order term will come in to contribute, but, you know, that's another story. And then they also kept the dipole coupling, the specular part of the dipole coupling. So this is what they get. They get the kind of the orientation dependence of the decay. Okay, this is the Hahn echo of that phosphorus electron spin. Okay, and they get the overall trend, which is pretty good. The only thing that they don't get very well is that initially the spin echo signal actually drops pretty fast, And then, you know, the long-term trend was pretty well described, but that part was not particularly well understood at that point when they did the calculation. Okay. So that actually prompted us to actually pursue this part. You know, after all, you want to do your quantum computing at short times, right? Not after you do spin echo, you wait a long time to do any manipulation. You want to do it at the time when your coherence is still out there. Okay, so we want to understand that, and that brings us to the point where you try to look at the hyperfine interaction more carefully and realize that for a silicon phosphor system, you have to take into consideration the anisotropic part of the hyperfine interaction. Now, as I mentioned before, the hyperfine interaction is a dipole-dipole interaction, so you have a contact part, okay, which is basically when the electron is at the nuclear site. So generally, that term dominates. And in gallium arsenide, for example, it really dominates because the gallium arsenide electron orbital is essentially atomic s orbitals. Okay, so you cannot have an anisotropic contribution there. But in silicon, let's see. Oh, I don't have that diagram there. In silicon, remember, the conduction band minimum were way off towards the boundary of the Brillouin zone. What it indicates is that the silicon, the low energy conduction band silicon electron states have a large component in p states, in d states, not just s states. Okay. So in silicon, turn out the anisotropic part of the interaction is pretty strong. And you can go calculate for a silicon phosphor system. In fact, people did those calculations back in, I think, early 70s, and did measurements as well in the late 60s to early 70s. So there's pretty good tabulation of how these interaction strengths are, depending on where the nuclear spin is sitting next to the phosphorus. So where is the silicon 29? Where is the silicon 29? Nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor, second nearest neighbor, etc. Okay, there's actually good tabulation there. So what we did was to take that data, and given what the experimentalists know about their system, let's say the density of their phosphorus, the density of whether they have natural silicon or isotopically purified silicon, you can actually go calculate what should be the effect of these, you know, additional contributions into the hyperfine interaction. Okay, how they actually affect the spin echo signal. And what we find is like this. Okay, so it's actually very fast oscillation there for the so-called electron spin echo envelope modulation. If we assume all the silicon 29 has exactly the same environment, if we actually assume there's some small strain in the system, randomly distributed in the system, actually I think we assumed 0.4%, then, you know, different phosphorus would actually have slightly different, different silicon 29 would have slightly different frequencies, and that will add up to decay of this echo modulation. Okay, so we take that, basically this theory, which I would say the only fitting parameter we introduced was this strain distribution, and we try to fit to experimental observations done in Steve Lyne's group, and this is what we get. So the angle there is really the angle between the magnetic field and I think the 001 direction, the z direction. Basically, you know, dipolar interaction actually depends on the angle of your, you know, crystalline axis and the magnetic field. So you will see slightly different signals. So the black line is the experimental observation of the spin echo decay, and the theory with, you know, the fit here, there is an exponential fit that is for the spin relaxation. So we don't know where the spin relaxation come from. Anyway, they are relatively slow in this system, presumably coming from electron-electron dipole interaction, but we don't know. We just fit it. And the spectral diffusion here is a super exponential decay, but really this is just a fitting of theory on theory, because what Wayne did in the spectral diffusion calculation there, he did an analytical calculation and then tried to fit his result here, fit the analytical result with a chosen, you know, functional form, because the result he had doesn't have a simple functional form. He just chose this super exponential and try to fit that in. Try to fit that in. What is the kind of the best fit he can get? So it's really a theory on theory fit, not a theory on experiment fit. Okay. So with those.
What is the role of this anisotropy hyperfine interaction which you showed before?
Okay, so what is the role here? If you think about the physics here, what it does is, you know, what we get this extra term. Not only you have the SZIZ term, but you also have SZIX term. Generally, we throw these terms away in dipolar interaction, right? Because they are not energy conserving. You have one spin doesn't change, the other spin flip. So, you know, generally when we even calculate decoherence, we throw these terms away. But what it really is that you have an electron spin. Depending on the direction of the electron spin, the nuclear spin would feel a slightly different direction of the magnetic field. Right? So assume this is your external field. Now depending on whether electron goes this way or that way, the nuclear spin actually feels a magnetic field that goes this way or that way. So it will process in this field indifferently. It's actually coherent in that sense. And in fact, Lucan's group proposed to use this to manipulate the nuclear spin instead of treating it as decoherence. Okay.
I misunderstand, but my question was parameter values, how would they enter actually the theory?
You mean this?
Yeah, and how important is the anisotropy important for the agreement between theory?
Yeah, so basically these are the theory without the anisotropy. And this would be the theory with the anisotropy. So whatever this slight modulation,
you can't get Eason without the anisotropy.
Yeah. So you know the echo envelope, this echo envelope modulation has to come from this type of anisotropies. Okay. So this were kind of the fit.
What kind of modulation gives you this complicated theoretical behavior?
Why can't...
What kind of compilation gives you this complicated theoretical behavior?
Which part is complicated? You mean these oscillations? Well, you know, what you did, you know, originally it wasn't that complicated, right? That's before you introduced the strain. So what we did was, you know, you have an ensemble of system. Okay, these are bulk experiments. So we assume that, you know, for different silicon 29, because of local strains, there will be slight modification to its energy. Okay, and when you introduce a distribution of that strain in the order of 0.5%, then that gives you this, you know, so now you have randomness in your system. Okay, when you add up, you get this kind of little jiggles.
Was the model just like a uniform distribution of values for the constants, or was it some different model? Did you imagine some uniaxial strain, or what was the idea?
Well, so the idea is that when you have strain, you can change the, for example, change the populations in different valleys. That will modify your hyperfine interaction strengths.
Yeah, no, I understand how strain can change the coupling constants, but what did you mean in mathematically? So did you just take a uniform distribution of coupling constants centered about some average value? With width, it's 0.4.
I don't remember what it is, whether it was a Gaussian distribution or just a kind of a step distribution.
Impurities in different places, or is it in the surface?
Well, how should I say this? We talked to Steve Lyon. I think the conclusion is we don't know. It could come from the surface. It could come from, well, impurity, I doubt, to tell the truth, because these are very pure systems. Okay, their impurities are the phosphorus. Let's put it that way. Okay, yeah. And these are bulk experiments, so presumably surface should have a reasonably small effect. Okay, but still, you know, not all phosphorus are substitutional or interstitials. There are all these things. You can have, you know, dislocations, whatever. Okay, so all these different things could certainly give you local strains. Okay. So, I would say that we don't know exactly what can give you this number of distribution for strain, but we can imagine different scenarios. Okay. I just want to show these fits because they look kind of eerily good. So as you would change the direction of the magnetic field, it doesn't move anymore. Okay. And that's what you get. Okay, and we know that the contribution to the to this ECM, the echo envelope modulation, mostly come from the nearest neighbor contributions. The nearest neighbor contribution is the largest among all the all the possible configurations, meaning that the contribution comes largest when the silicon 29 sits right next to your phosphorus. So it's a small probability, but still, they give you the largest contribution to the echo. So we actually suggest that, well, you can actually put in put your magnetic field along certain directions so that the nearest neighbor positions will all contribute in the same way, in the same frequency or same direction for the anisotropic term, so that the echo modulation frequency will come out to be the same, so that at least you can imagine going back, let's see, going back from such type of a modulation to such type where you have a fixed modulation frequency, so that at least you can find places where you can have a good signal. Okay, but that's assuming that you mostly have the nearest neighbor contribution, which we know it's at least 90% of the echo modulation come from the nearest neighbor contribution. Okay. So I just want to say that we believe that we have a quite good understanding of the silicon phosphorus coherence. Okay. Not only the general spectral diffusion, but also up to the kind of the next order, looking at this further detailed effect, we also can have a reasonable consistency between theory and experimental understanding of this system. Okay. Now, actually, having said that, the latest results that Steve Lyon produced of this T2 time in the order of 0.3 seconds, but his T1 time is much longer, and he tried to do all these dynamic decoupling schemes, which presumably should push his T2 to close to T1. But in fact, it's still way different. So I guess there are still things that we don't really understand. Maybe it's just really experimental, some engineering or technological details in there. But that's my feeling. But
the thing that he does to do the decoupling itself can cause a lot of trouble too. I mean, why would he expect to achieve T1 using that?
Well, I guess since sometimes he thinks the same as the theorist too. But if I do proper dynamic decoupling, I should be able to. Which is, in for example, in Amir Jacobi's experiment, I would say he probably was pushing T1. Okay, looking at his signal, when he did, 6 pulse CPMG or something like that, he got his T2 time kind of going in the same similar slope as his presumed T1. He didn't really measure T1, but it seems like they go in a similar slope. Okay, so that give you a sense that maybe in that system they're actually pushing close to T1 in his particular system. But in phosphorus, Steve Lyon knew that he's not nowhere close to T1 for his T2. Okay, so I don't know. I would say within what we know of all the interactions, I think we have a reasonable understanding. But there are still open things.
So people have actually done experiments using this idea, and they got some
results. These are fits, right? The black lines are experiments. They were done before we did our calculation.
After your calculation, have people implemented
them? Oh, did they try to actually modify? I don't think so. They have bigger fishes to fry, I guess.
So what's involved in doing the experiment with your idea?
This is simply saying that, in silicon phosphorus, you would have to take into account this anisotropic part of the hyperfine interaction to really give a more thorough description of what you observe in the experiment. Whether in a realistic system, whether you actually want to use that or not, that really is a next level of consideration. That is not really something that we are too concerned about right now.
How many nucleus beans are actually relevant now?
In this experiment? Now, these sets of data, I think, are natural silicon, so 5%. And the bore radius is, 2-3 nanometer? And the lattice constant is 5, half.
How can you get to the material that was used at 0.3 seconds?
That's highly isotopically purified.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How does that affect?
Oh, this would be much smaller, right? Your probability of having the silicon 29 sitting next to a phosphorus could go to zero then.
Well, you'd like to think it's taking people.
Right. Yeah. So I would imagine, I haven't seen his actual data for the 0.3 second measurement, but I would imagine these modulations would be much less prominent compared to here.
How many nucleus things did you take into account in this calculation?
In this calculation, it's, as I said, 5%. So it's a single nucleus spin calculation. Let me try to calculate. Let's say bore radius is 5, so I count for 10 nanometer. Too big already, 5 nanometer. So 10, like 1,000. So 1,000 nuclear sites and 5%, right? So 50 nuclear spin, 50 silicon 29. No, this is actually not. It's a single spin calculation. So basically, you just consider one nuclear spin actually happen to sit next to your phosphorus. What is its effect on the electron spin?
But it's only one nucleus.
No, so you're averaging over, but there's no nuclear-nuclear interaction. So at the end of the day, it's just single spin calculation.
Okay, you have 50 nuclear spins.
Yeah, so you have all these nuclear spins, but you actually, when you do calculation, it's one electron with one nuclear spin calculation. Right? Then you sum over all these different nuclear spins.
How do you justify the agreement then?
Oh, so the nuclear-nuclear interaction and what that induced, that gave you the spectral diffusion, the overall trend. Okay, so that goes back to here.
So you computed, just to paraphrase before, this cluster computation of weights, okay,
gave you this.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not linear. At the zeroth order, it's just this one body terms, right? This single nucleus and single electron spin interaction multiplied together, the results multiplied together.
Those modifications, yeah.
And then you're saying, well, I neglected some things, let me add on this phenomenological, in the sense that it's a theory that is not the theory you're using, right? But it's still a theory.
So basically what we did...
Is that the premise here?
Yes. So basically you look back here, you take the dipole coupling, you take the contact hyperfine, and that will produce the spectral diffusion. And then the anisotropic hyperfine would be a correction to this, so we only basically take that part of the Hamiltonian at the first order, at the lowest order. See what I'm saying? So you have the spin Hamiltonian, that now we only have these terms, right? Okay, for both electron and all the nuclear spins. all the nuclear spin together will interact with each other through the dipole interaction. So you have to account for that.
The missing piece here, the thing that's being swept under the rug somehow, is that this anisotropy also mediates interaction, leads to stronger mediating interactions between nuclear spins.
Sure, sure. So we don't have that in there. Yeah.
So you're right. No hyperfine flip-flop terms.
Either direction.
The flip-flop terms would be removed by the spin cycle.
But you re-include this by having this phenomenological decadence.
Which one?
This T2SD.
T2SD. Yeah, T2SD was...
T2SD is calculated with all these things.
Right. The T2SD has only... This is where the T2SD come from. Okay. So you take this part of the Hamiltonian, you calculate, and you get a fitting onto the system, and then you try to fit that lines with this T2SD here, with a particular end there.
Was the T1 time measured independently to get this TR
I don't know whether they actually measured. It was a pure fitting parameter to get the exponential part of the decay of the curve.
That's all. What can we expect for T1?
If I remember, I think it was reasonable. It's much longer than the spectral diffusion time.
If it's much longer, why isn't it there?
They try to, I think Wayne was trying to kind of fit all the tails and everything. To me, it doesn't actually matter because I only care about the short time. But okay, so got it? That the interaction there was accounted for that way, while the anisotropic part was only taken into consideration in the first order. So it doesn't include the anisotropic mediated nuclear spin interaction and those type of interaction. No, that doesn't. That's not it.
Let me ask a common question.
Mm-hmm.
If I look at one single phosphorus purity in your system, I would expect for each given phosphorus impurity, it has a sort of unique environment associated with the location of silicon 29 nearby.
Yes.
Have you had a chance, or have you thought about what the distribution of Hahn echo curves looks like?
Distribution of Hahn echo curve.
So we see the mean over this ensemble, but there's also some distribution, some fluctuations associated with number statistics. I'm curious.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to think about that, or have you looked at any of that?
What we did in that
special phosphorus, some special impurities, which you can distinguish by the spectral characteristics. This ensemble of potential.
Well, presumably, if you actually can find them.
Silicon 29 very close, which are fast and short bananas.
Right.
And ones that have no silicon 29 anywhere nearby. Mm-hmm. So two special classes which should somehow show up in this distribution. I'd be curious to understand to what extent the curve you see is contributed to from these two
classes. By these particular classes. No, our understanding is that
I look at the top section here and I just infer the depth of that top section to be a measure of the number of phosphorus pairs in the nearest neighbor silicon section.
No, I think that's a good point. Let's see. So from our calculation, what we see is that all the spin modulation, the echo modulation results, about 90% comes from those guys who have the silicon 29 in the nearest neighbor. Okay, so I can only give you that statistical data. I don't know if I just take one out, how exactly it should look. Okay, so
we did a very similar calculation for NB centers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge distribution, very wide range of effective T2 terms.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the same calculation because it includes these cluster terms as well. But I mean, the distribution turns out to be very non-trivial.
Because of what?
Because the anisotropy means that not only is it nearby, but it's very distant relative to
the geometry.
The geometry.
Yeah. No, certainly the geometry, the orientation of where this nearest neighbor relative to the V field certainly is something that, yeah, certainly is an important consideration. Now, I think I run way out of time, so I'll have to stop here.
Can you explain what exactly the calculation?
What?
What exactly the calculation is being done?
Okay. Let me see if I get that more detailed talk. Basically, what we do is we come up with this the echo envelope. Okay, so you assume kind of 5% nuclear spin where you would have a certain modification for the electron spin echo signal.
So you assume nothing about this kind of.
Okay, so you start from here, right? You have some Hamiltonian, which is really simple Hamiltonian.
It's a many-body Hamiltonian.
I don't know. It's a two-body Hamiltonian, right?
Two-body.
It's one electron spin, one nuclear spin. Looking at how that electron spin would modify this nuclear spin's dynamics.
But you just dynamize.
If it's just two spins, there's no decay, right? So you have to have some environment.
No, there are lots of spins, but the interaction is two bunny.
Yeah, okay. So,
yeah. So it's just a hyperfine interaction. When you have these two, so for each possible configuration, it's very easy to diagonalize, right? You just have two spins. One electron spin for the phosphorus, one silicon 29 sitting somewhere in the environment. So depending on where it sits, you would have a particular A and B signal. Okay.
You only diagonalize the two spin Hamiltonian?
So you diagonalize that, and then you look back at how, so you find out what is the nuclear spin dynamics, right? Okay, depending on what the electron spin orientation is.
Just a 4x4 Hamiltonian or a 4x4 matrix?
Is it even, 4x4, right.
Okay.
Right, okay. So then you look at when the electron evolves, do spin echo, right? How that will...
Where did this decay come from?
What decay?
Well, you had some decay.
Okay, so...
So
there you don't have any decay, right?
Okay, so this
is coming from 4x4, right?
It's spin coupled to spin, but this other spin is coupled to
a bath. Yes, this is what I'm trying to understand. Yeah. Where
so this other spin is coupled to a bath.
So the overall decay is from that.
Right, but that's not what.
Okay. The overall.
In the calculation, you don't need that, right? In the calculation.
In this particular calculation, you just say that. Okay, so think about it this way, right? You go back to this part. Okay, so you deal with the hyperfine plus the contact part of the nuclear, contact part of the hyperfine plus the nuclear dipole-dipole interaction, that will give you a certain dynamics, right? You don't, this one is out, that one is out, and you throw away the anisotropic part of the hyperfine, put it away. Okay, for the moment. You can solve the system, you get the dynamics, which give you this overall decay. This overall decay.
You have to solve a many body problem
right.
To get this decay.
Right, that's where, Jake was talking about the graph expansion. That
from some other field.
Right.
And what are the assumptions there in this theory? You can't solve this kind of Hamiltonian, so you have to do some kind of approximation. So.
Well, let's see. You're talking about the spectral diffusion there?
Yeah, I guess.
This part?
Yeah.
This part, if I remember, he basically account for, you know, pair of nuclear spin flip-flop, two pairs, you know, three nuclear spin having flip-flops. You know, so basically you do a systematic expansion, how these flip-flops would come in and affect the electron spin.
Okay, and then you get this kind of super exponential behavior.
Right. So that's the where this behavior come from. So that, now the question is, well, we couldn't explain that, so we want to see, well, if there is a different factor that contribute to that, and that is where the anisotropic part comes in. Okay. So for this part, you know, as Bill was saying, it would be just, I would just consider one nuclear spin at a time, how that nuclear spin precession would be affected by the electronic states. Okay, and then when I account for all the nuclear spins processing differently because of my nuclear spin, because of my electron spin state, then I look back at the environment the electron has with all these processing nuclear spins, how those nuclear spins affect the electron spin echo.
So the reason that you can solve it easily is because all of these can compute with each other.
So
it's
yeah, you'll
block that many blocks.
For this part.
No interaction
between the. You don't, as I was replying to Jake, I don't consider whether, you know, you can have these type of interactions that mediate nuclear spin interaction with each other.
Okay, so it's completely blocked diagonal. So you can.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Why in this HN you don't take the... because this is already kind of taken into account. Don't you have any flip-flop terms there in the HN?
The flip-flop terms are already accounted for.
This is already accounted for in the previous...
Right, in the previous calculation. Exactly.
But it's kind of a phenomenological
calculation,
not systematic.
Yeah, it doesn't...
So they were excluded from the previous calculation.
You're seeing
like...
What do we mean?
Perspective of
uh-huh.
You seem like that it feels high enough. So
the electron nuclear spin flip flop term was not accounted for in that calculation. Right. Right. So you know you go to a higher order of hyperfine, that's not there. You know, if you look back at, I think I wrote it out pretty clearly.
Yeah, but
not here.
You also kind of also the electron nuclear terms are kind of taken into account first, and then you also add this kind of anisotropic interaction.
Right, so basically you account for one part of the Hamiltonian first and consider the rest of it as a perturbation and add in the perturbation there.
But there is no small parameter.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be like a systematic expansion. Yeah.
No, it's not a systematic expansion for sure, yes. Anyways, it's a short time calculation, right? You care about the short time there. And the spectral diffusion at that point was still not kicking in yet, so you're really looking at just essentially the single spin physics. Do not contribute.
But you still write the evolution as a product.
Yes. No, we don't. We can only justify it by saying that look at the signal. Since I really care about there, the effect of the spectral diffusion should still be very small, and at that part, the physics should be dominated by this. Because it's really single spin physics, it's not higher order. So.
Well, I do agree with this.
Sure. Yeah, that will be more systematic for sure. Yes.
Very small, but the field is not.
I don't think it's very small. It's a couple Tesla or something like that.
Yeah, it's experimental.
Yeah, if I remember correctly.
The scales are also
great. Right. When you're in silicon, you know, your G factor is almost 5 times larger, right? 4 times larger. So the energy scale is there. harmonic at half.
So what about the map?
Well, yeah, we actually did. I actually wanted to show the next part more about, you know, calculating the hyperfine interaction in a quantum dot. And then there's also the valley stuff. But
why is there supercomputing in silicon quantum dots?
Why should be? You know, the I think the silicon germanium people believe they have a reasonably large valley splitting. From interface.
Does one have to run the real calculation to say that it makes sense?
So you want me to continue my talk? Okay. So what you know? So what we did was very simple. Actually, there were quite some works after quantum computing becomes hard, trying to calculate value splitting in these structures, whether it's a quantum well or quantum dot. So there were quite a bit of literature already there. These calculations were all tight binding type. You don't really gain much insight into it. And these are kind of effective mass married to... No, there's nothing wrong. It's just you couldn't really... You don't have a very intuitive picture. You know, actually, why there should be. You have an interface, okay? So your electron come in here and scatter off your interface. Because if the interface is sharp enough, then an electron in this valley can be scattered over to that valley. Okay, so that way you have a valley orbit coupling, your two valleys are coupled together. That will give you a valley splitting where you have, let's say, this one plus this one as a lower valley, this one minus this one as a higher valley. Okay, so it depends on the scattering strength essentially. Okay, so you can do tight binding calculation of that as well as just take an effective mass, which is what we did, the simplest possible calculation. You know, you throw in a sharp interface, for example, and then you look at how these different values can couple to each other. Okay, what we get. Something in that order, fraction of MeV. Now, way smaller than what the Japanese saw in their experiments. Yeah, a fraction of. As a function of how high the barrier is. So silicon oxide would have a 3 eV barrier, really high. Silicon germanium, the barrier height is only a fraction. I think it's somewhere there. Yeah, it's somewhere over here. Well, the silicon oxide barrier is way over there, very large. There's kind of an interesting dependence there for the valley orbit coupling. Basically, when we did the calculation, we find that there are different contributions into that coupling. You have a kind of a delta function contribution from the sharp interface. You also have a contribution from the evanescent wave that leak out into the barrier. Okay. So when you add all these together, you get something like that. But what we get number-wise is not large, not small, I would say. You know, it's not 0.01 MeV, but it's also not 1 MeV, 2 MeV. Okay.
It's also introduces spin orbit interaction.
In our calculation, no, we didn't consider that in terms of introducing spin orbit interaction.
Strong electric field.
Oh, okay. You're talking about the Rushwa then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sure. Yeah. You could certainly have Rushwa. We didn't calculate Rushwa in here. But Rushwa would be coupling. that, wouldn't that be a higher order contribution to valley splitting? You know, these are orbital-orbital couplings. Yeah, in addition, you will have Raj. Yes, yes.
That's the problem, actually, when you split your valleys like this,
the size from you get smaller interaction, yes. My understanding, well, I wouldn't say my understanding. What I know of is that I know Bob Joyne's group did some calculation about the size of Rush bar they should get, and their conclusion was it should be still be very small in silicon germanium. I don't know about silicon oxide, which has a much stronger electric field at interface. Okay. In silicon germanium, they can make their quantum dot almost symmetric. Okay. Which could then make the Rush bar a bit smaller. Okay.
They can be used to see
actually
what the
problem
is.
Yeah. No, I
actually these problems are wrong. Mm-hmm. Why did he want? Because they give you information about the spin orbit. I mean, it's been full known at night.
Yeah. How strong those relaxation channels would be, right? They would give you an upper bound. Sorry. Yeah, no, it's for silicon. Yeah, silicon dots would generally be relatively small, so yes. Generally, this interaction energy, this splitting would be smaller than the orbital excitation energy, the SP splittings. Yeah.
But so in the excited state spectroscopy that was done in transport, you mm-hmm. based on these huge splittings, you said.
That was a measurement. That was not in the quantum dot. That was on the interface. Okay. So they believe that's actually a valley splitting, even though other people think it might be just inter-subband transition going from the lowest one to the next subband. Because the 2 and 4 are split, so it's really just going between 2 and 4 instead of within the 2. But, you know, that I don't know. I actually talked to them a little bit. They said they did Shubnikov the Haas measurements where, you know, the mass would come in so that you can actually distinguish the 2 and the 4. And, you know, in Shubnikov the Haas, they have, it comes from the 2. But in these measurements, I think, you know, if it is a transition, you don't know where it goes, then, you know, even if you start with everything in the 2, you could still have transition into the 4, right? So whether originally they are all in 2 or not, actually doesn't really tell you whether that 10 really comes from within the 2 or actually going from the intercept.
So are they compatible with the Wisconsin experiments?
Their own measurement, they had a set of measurement, I think in a quantum point contact or something, and they claim they go up to like half MeV value splitting. I think even in one of the papers they had that. I think so. It's more like a traditional 2D gas type of measurement where basically you make the 2D gas smaller and smaller. Okay, in a transport experiment. I don't think they have a publication specifically on this valley splitting measurement.
But why would it be that they have twice the valley splitting? How do I understand the
Oh, the numbers? I wouldn't say our numbers can actually predict what they do because, you know, it's a very simple effective mass calculation. I would say if you really want to predict more carefully, you need to take into account the interface roughness. You know, roughness has, if they have atomic scale, they can certainly couple values, right? Which we don't. We just assume a smooth, even if I have a finite width of the interface, it's still a smooth interface. Okay.
What energy time is this?
What kind of?
T1 time, like.
This has nothing to do with T1 time. So it doesn't predict anything about T1.
So I understand very.
Oh, you mean it in, as I said, we didn't consider the whatever spin orbit coming out of this field. So, you know, we couldn't, all these are completely electronic side, orbital side, no spin involved. Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, there are certainly we, at least I feel a bit more optimistic than 3 years ago even. 3 years ago, there's no experimental results. Now, at least there are results where you can compare, and hopefully there are T1 measurements or measurement of charge noise. You know, the thing I worry the most is whether the silicon dioxide interface would produce just overwhelming amount of charge noise that, you know, you can't really do much. It's oxide. Grown on silicon, so it's known that near the interface, within a couple of nanometers, there could be a lot of traps in there. They can do things, hydrogen specific elevation or whatever, to try to reduce that density. But still, so far
the silicon germanium looks actually.
They look most promising. Yes, indeed. Yes, and they don't have oxide, so they're supposedly their interface should be relatively clean. If you look at the cross section of the silicon germanium, it looks really bad, like dislocations everywhere, because you have to relax the silicon germanium until, you know, you again get good quality of silicon germanium, and then you grow silicon. So there, yeah, they I would say they have done the most for the past few years.
People have done
our
silicon germanium
nanowires. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they have. You mean the Lieber, Marcus, those guys, or?
Vitaltesky.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't know he starts to do this.
These are silicon germanium nanowires.
Yeah.
Shell in, shell out, shell.
Yeah.
Gate defined.
Yeah. So that's a germanium core, right?
Yeah.
Germanium core, silicon outside, and it's holes, right? Yeah, pretty sure if you just have a straight germanium with silicon outside, it's holes confined in there. It's pretty interesting physics. I can imagine that. I saw some. Yeah, I saw data from Lieber and Marcus collaboration there. They were doing this type of nanowire as well. That was pretty interesting. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.